82 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. Growing calls from Democrats for President Biden to drop out of the election. They include Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland and Jim Costa of California, along with Senator John Tester of Montana. CBS's Robert Costa.
I've never seen the Democratic Party, which I've covered for over 15, 16 years, so nervous, skittish at the upper ranks.
CBS's Weijia Zhang on President Biden's COVID battle.
The president's doctor says that he is still experiencing mild symptoms, but he will continue to do the business of the American people as he isolates at his beach house in Delaware.
Former President Donald Trump on stage now at the Republican National Convention, where he's about to accept the GOP presidential nomination. Franklin Graham earlier told the
crowd. Things that he said he'll do, he did. When he told me and our country in 2016 that he was going to appoint conservative justices, guess what? He did.
CBS News Special Report, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Some big Wisconsin political figures say they would work for Donald Trump if he wins the White House again. Former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark said there aren't any plans in motion, but if he was asked, of course he would serve in a new Republican administration. During Trump's first term in office, Clark was considered for a post in the Department of Homeland Security. He withdrew his acceptance when news surfaced that he plagiarized his master's thesis. And former Governor Scott Walker is currently president of the group Young Americans for Freedom. He didn't rule out the idea. And Wisconsin has broken another employment record. New numbers from the Department of Workforce Development show the highest employment rate ever last month. The previous record was from May. Governor Tony Evers credited programs that strengthen the workforce through added access to education and fast-tracking licensing. That's been a big focus of his administration as governor. And that's what you need to know. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson for Civic Media News.
Hey, Wisconsin, it's construction season, and the Wisconsin DOT wants to help you safely navigate work zones in your area. Check 511WI.gov or download the free 511 app to see current road work, closures, detours, and camera views on your route. Wherever your travels take you, know before you go with 511WI.gov. That's 511WI.gov. And remember, know before you go. Always park the phone while driving. Sponsored by the Wisconsin DOT.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about, a lot of news about Sean O'Brien, the Teamsters president, all over the place. In fact, this is the most news that I've seen about my Teamsters union probably in my whole life. This has been a kind of a big deal. A lot of people not thrilled, some happy, most seem to be negative. And in fact, seems to be a little division within the organization itself, a little palace intrigue. Whereas President O'Brien tweeted out an article from Josh Hawley. He put Josh Hawley is 100% on point. Someone inside the house, they kind of questioned it. And on the Teamsters official Twitter page, they wrote, O'Brien reads this article and evidently agreed with it 100%, including this part, where they quote Josh Hawley's article saying, quote, the C-suite using the profits to push diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the religion of the trans flag. Now, he's talking about, you know, jobs being lost and moving overseas. But the person inside the house was like, unions gain nothing from endorsing the racist, misogynistic, and anti-trans politics of the far right, no matter how many people like Senator Hawley attempt to tether such bigotry to a cynical pro-labor message, the message this sends to Teamsters of color, Teamster women, and LGBTQ Teamsters is that they are not welcome in the union unless they surrender their identity to a new kind of anti-woke unionism. You don't unite a diverse working class by scoffing at its diversity. And look, I've been saying for a bit, I've been thinking the Teamsters been moving in the anti-woke direction for a bit. And look, there's an argument to be had for saying we're just going to talk about wages, hours, conditions. It's blinders on just about the job. There's an argument for that. Now, a lot of people get into the labor movement because they do believe, as I do, that the labor movement is where we can change not just our workplaces, but our communities for the better. It's where we unite people and find common interest. And I fear this speech on Monday night and a lot of the discussion is tearing us apart. Because here's the thing, and here's what I think everyone universally knows, that Donald Trump and the Republican Party, they are a clear and present danger to working people. And the weird thing is there's a document out there, this Project 2025, kind of a wet dream list for Republican ideologues that would do some really terrible things. And look, they break it down. They write it down for us. They're literally telling us what they want to do. And what they want to do is they want to change this country for what they believe is the better, what I would argue is bad for working people. They want to completely gut all of the diversity, all of the equity, all of that stuff, completely do away with it. They want to systematically do away with labor unions, dismantle workers' rights to organize. And as I was reading through it, you know, they talk about work councils, they talk about employee involvement organizations, not unions with actual rights, but just suggestion box unions. You know, just, you know, you can feel like you're having your input heard, but yeah, you don't. And that's the kind of company union thinking that truly, you know, built the labor movement of my grandparents' generation. Company unions don't work. And we know that. I hope we don't have to relearn it again. Also, you read through Project 2025, women. There shouldn't be a woman voting for a Republican ever in this day and age, because this Project 2025 calls for an end to abortion and going after contraception. They don't go as far as I think they really want to, but it's attacking the ACA because, you know, employers have religious concerns. I don't give a rat's behind about the employer's religious concern. If someone works for them, that's their insurance and they should get what they need. We shouldn't have benevolent little dictators having control of our health. And there isn't a union person on this planet that wouldn't agree with that. The other thing is, one of the hallmarks of trade unionism, the sanctity of the 8-hour day. They want to do away with it completely. They say that Congress should give employers and employees flexibility to calculate overtime. You know, you can choose. You as the worker, you have the choice. And I love how they do this. You have choice. You, the hyper-individual, you're going to make the good choice for you. We're going to give you a broken-down public school and a voucher, and you can choose between bad and worse. We're going to give you the choice. You can choose to work 100 hours this week and, well, none next week. And we're not going to pay you overtime. Because, look, business flows are what they are. We need more people today, not so many tomorrow. I work in a feast or famine industry. I know what that's like. I know what that will look like. You know what? During the busy months, you're going to work your you-know-what's to the you-know-where. But, you know, come, well, you know, when it's slow, yeah, take some time off. Take some time for yourself. Re-energize. Do you think it really, honestly, stop and think of your own situation. Do you think your employer would create a system that would be beneficial to you or to himself? Do you think that they would go, here's your choice. Completely up to you. Completely up to you if you want to work the overtime or the excess hours, you know, down the road, you know, we'll make it up down the road. That's telling me they're not hiring enough employees, and they're putting the onus on you to make up for their managerial shortfalls. But that's, hey, just me. Now, the weird thing is, and again, this is where some of the criticism of Sean O'Brien is, and as I've said before, I don't question his passion to fight for working people. But this stuff, scary. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. When we come back, Stephen Greenhouse is going to be here to share some thoughts on the speech and, well, what it's going to mean to the labor movement. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, wow, what a couple of days it has been for the Teamsters Union as their general president. Getting a lot of ink. There is a lot of press right now about Sean O'Brien and the Teamsters and his speech on Monday night in front of the RNC. And look, a lot of it not really great. Some of it, you know, he was courageous and all that stuff. But a lot of bad press. And I'm not sure if that's what he was looking for. And look, at the end of the day, some believe there's no such thing as bad press. The fact that the Teamster's name is being used is a good thing, I guess. Might bring some people around. We'll see. But here to share some thoughts on, well, how'd the speech go? What's it going to mean in this election cycle? And should he have done it? I've asked our good friend Stephen Greenhouse to come talk with us. He's a labor journalist, former New York Times reporter, and author of numerous books. His most recent, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here. So
let's jump right into it. What's your thoughts?
So I wrote a big article for Slate about O'Brien's appearance. And I think, you know, he was trying to show he was bipartisan because his union is very divided between Biden supporters and Trump supporters. A narrow majority of Teamsters support Biden. So he said, well, let me try to, let me seek an invitation to speak at both conventions, the Republican convention, Democratic convention. The Republicans, of course, wanted to invite him because that's a coup. They could say, we have this big, famous, quote, tough, unquote, union leader talking. And it was good that O'Brien, spoke out robustly and eloquently against corporate greed. I didn't expect that. And I'm sure that surprised some of the, billionaire business donors attending. But on the other side, O'Brien's been fiercely criticized because by going to speak to the Republicans, yes, it's nice you're condemning corporate greed, but you are giving the Teamster seal of approval to a presidential candidate, Donald Trump, and to a party that have been consistently anti-union and anti-worker. Trump did nothing to raise the minimum wage. Trump rolled back, all sorts of regulations to increase worker safety, to increase safety in mines, to increase safety for farm workers. He appointed extremely anti-union people to the National Labor Relations Board. His three appointees to the Supreme Court are extremely anti-union, consistently voting against unions. So Trump and the GOP are going to say, O'Brien, is our show horse. He's our trophy. He's an important union leader. And look, this demonstrates that we, the Republican Party, we're not anti-union. We're really friends of unions and friends of workers. And the Washington Post story just came out a few minutes ago quoting all these business leaders who said, it's terrible that O'Brien went to speak to the Republicans. Biden has been arguably the most pro-union president in our history, maybe the most pro-union since FDR. So why is Sean O'Brien playing, you know, footsie with Donald Trump, who's been so anti-union, anti-worker? And, you know, the union spokeswoman, Kara Dennis, says, oh, we're bipartisan. We haven't endorsed anyone yet. It's going to be up to our rank and file whether we make an endorsement. But again, O'Brien's critics say, wait a second, even if you haven't made an endorsement, the fact that you, the head of such an important union, is speaking at Republican convention and in prime time, that's seen as giving your seal of approval to Trump. And that's what's pissed off so many Democrats in the White House. One more thing. So, you know, and I wrote this in my Slate piece that no doubt many Democrats and many union leaders are angry at O'Brien because, you know, Joe Biden, as soon as he took office, pushed extremely hard and faced, you know, tons of grief from the Wall Street Journal editorial board and Fox News for pushing for the bill that was the Teamsters' number one legislative priority. That was the Butch Lewis Emergency Pension Relief Act. You know, some 2-3 million workers and retirees, their pensions are threatened, that there won't be enough money to pay for their pensions. So Biden pushed through this $86 billion bill that will bail out the pensions of at least 500,000 Teamsters. There are 1.3 million Teamsters, so that's a lot of Teamsters. So I can imagine, so I can imagine Biden and the Democrats saying, you know, WTF, we busted our hump to pass this massive legislation to help the Teamsters in particular. And what happens? We feel stabbed in the back that O'Brien says he's being bipartisan. And in ways, it looks as if he's favoring Trump right now because he spoke at the Republican convention.
No, and it's what I said from the beginning, Stephen. I mean, the reality is his mere presence. No one's going to remember his words in the next month or so. Yeah, it's great. And look, he said the right words. He went after the Chamber of Commerce. He went after the Business Roundtable. And that's all great. I give him credit for that. But ultimately, he's their dancing show pony that they got to trot out and say, look, he said nice things about us. He said we're tough. He said we're courageous for having him come speak. He said all these great stuff. Trump got what he wanted. He got his 4 years in office completely wiped away. And he got O'Brien to say both sides suck, which takes away Joe Biden's number one argument to working people that he's the most pro-labor president, at least of my lifetime.
So O'Brien says he was courageous in appearing before a Republican convention. And it was, in ways, it was courageous, you know, going through these right-wing folks who are often very pro-business and very anti-union and usually anti-worker. And he did say some very pro-worker things. He did talk about how the nation's labor laws are far too weak and it's far too easy for corporations to fire pro-union workers and how insanely difficult it is for them to get their jobs back and how insanely difficult it often is for workers at Starbucks and Trader Joe's and other companies to get a first union contract to finally lift their wages and benefits. So that was good. But if he were really courageous, he would have been more truthful and said, you know, Joe Biden was the first president in American history to walk on a union picket line. That's great. Joe Biden, you know, passed Butch Lewis. Joe Biden passed the Infrastructure Act, which has created hundreds of thousands of union jobs. But he wasn't courageous enough to say that. And one of the crazy things is, like, yes, O'Brien, like many union leaders, wanted headlines, wanted fame. And if he had thrown in some nice words, nice lines about Biden, he would have been on the front page of every newspaper, you know, on every TV news report in the nation. But he didn't. And he, you know, that's why I think a lot of people felt that he unnecessarily kowtowed to Trump, that he could have been somewhat tougher towards Trump.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I think
a few days after the assassination attempt, so I realize you want to, you know, it's not a good time to criticize Donald Trump anyway. So.
But here's the thing. You know, I think they truly believe that they can reset the clock and have this bipartisan world where they get to set the agenda and both parties have to come to them for it. This isn't the 1950s and 60s. Or even the 80s and 90s where you had pro-labor Republicans. They've been ousted. And the fact that he said those things that, you know, labor laws are badly broken and workers are getting screwed over. Yeah, those people in the crowd know that because they're the ones who did it. They're the ones whose policies put this country in the place that it's in. So, yeah, he's courageous for saying it, but they already knew. In fact, they probably were celebrating on the way home going, look what we did. Now, here's the thing, and this is where I bring up, you know, this idea that we could have this kind of bipartisanship. There used to be pro-labor Republicans, but I would argue that's because you had much larger union density and more members who were demanding Republican representatives feed their needs. This is purely about power of working of the working class, and I don't think O'Brien and the Teamsters Strategic Department have a clue of what they're doing on this.
I think another factor, Rick, is that the gazillionaires, the billionaires, the donor class, dark money has much more power in elections. And when they give to Republicans, they don't want those Republicans saying a nice word for unions. They don't want the Republicans, lifting a finger to raise the minimum wage or to enact, horrible mandates like, requiring that companies give parents, paid leave if they, paid leave or paid sick days or paid vacation.
Or just pay minimum wage
for minimum wage too.
Yeah, but here's the thing. My grandfather always used to say, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it, because they understand return on investment. So I see Elon Musk going to give $45 million a month to Trump and Vance. You got a couple other billionaires who are throwing in. The moneyed interests are fully behind the Republicans. And you've got, again, O'Brien out there saying uncomfortable things, but still saying nice words. That those are going to be the campaign ads, not the tough words, the beautiful words, the very best words.
So again, O'Brien says he's courageous, and he gave a speech where he attacked corporate greed, and that was good. But he was speaking in front of Donald Trump, who, as president, was humongously anti-union. And, while O'Brien said we have our differences with the GOP, if you're really courageous, he would say, Mr. Trump, when you're president, you appointed anti-union people to the NLRB, to the Supreme Court. You did nothing on minimum wage. You rolled back all these regulations to help workers on safety and other things. If you're reelected, please do more, be serious about helping workers. And he didn't say that. Right. He wasn't that
there was great. No call to action. You're absolutely right. But here's the thing, saying what you just said, it's like standing on the gallows with the guy putting the noose around your neck going, I'm against rope. They're going to hang you anyway. You've got no choice in this. And this is where, again, I keep saying it wasn't courageous to go there. He got what he wanted. He got to say words. But Trump also got what he wanted. And that, to me, is the most important part of this. Trump got what he wanted. He got the tacit endorsement. He got the endorsement of Sean O'Brien, if not the Teamsters.
Right. And we can expect to see lots of campaign ads showing, Sean O'Brien saying, look, this shows, Sean O'Brien spoke at our convention. This shows he likes us. This shows that we are friends of labor. This shows that we are friends of workers. And I fear, you used the phrase show pony, but I fear that O'Brien let himself be used, unwittingly used, to help elect Trump.
Let me be clear.
And we could have the scenario where not only Trump wins, thanks in part to help from the Teamsters, but the Republicans win control of the House and Senate. And we're going to see workers and union get steamrolled. One thing that really upset me, I'm going to speak carefully. So there's an article in the Boston Globe yesterday where O'Brien spoke Monday morning to O'Brien used to be a truck driver in Boston, right? So he spoke to the Massachusetts delegation to the Republican convention. And he said he's unhappy with Joe Biden for failing to achieve things for unions. And he said that Biden failed to win enactment of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which Biden pushed very hard for. And the reason the Protecting Right to Organize Act was defeated was because Republicans were universally against it. And every Republican senator was against it, so it couldn't overcome a filibuster. So then someone, I guess, at the Massachusetts breakfast said, well, if Trump wins, that's gonna kill the PRO Act as well. And then O'Brien told the reporter or told the breakfast, it won't be impossible to pass the PRO Act with Trump as president. So either O'Brien is being, this is in the Boston Globe, I'm not making it up. So O'Brien is either being dishonest with himself or being dishonest with, the public, because if Trump is elected, there's no way in the world the PRO Act is going to pass. Unless Trump had a lobotomy or something and decides I'm going to embrace and kiss and love and love labor and do what they want. But I don't see that happening.
So maybe that's what they talked about at Mar-a-Lago back in January, with the whole thumbs up hostage picture. Maybe that's it. So let me ask you, the rest of the labor movement, what's the reaction been in your world? What's the reaction been by the rest of labor to this speech? I can't imagine. Can't imagine. Great.
So, there's this Washington Post story that quotes Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO. She says she agrees with what O'Brien's critique of corporate greed in his GOP speech. But absolutely, she said, but Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are on the boss's side. We won't be fooled, said Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO, the nation's main labor federation. Matthew Biggs, the painter of the Professional Technical and Engineers Union, said, it's disappointing to see a national union leader speak at the GOP convention. Make no mistake about it, the GOP's intent is to crush federal workers' unions and have mass firings of federal employees. Jimmy Williams, the president of the Painters Union, he's a good progressive union leader. He called O'Brien, quote, a brother of mine, but he noted that on this issue of appearing before the Republican convention, we respectfully disagree. And Williams said, the Republican Party platform doesn't do a thing to help unions or working people. And what we are hearing in this campaign is no different. And when union leaders are speaking that critically, publicly, you can imagine what they're saying between themselves privately. They must be super duper irate. And they really feel that O'Brien is undercutting labor. I did a story where I quoted, former labor union officials said, if Biden loses, we don't know whether Biden's going to remain in the race. There's a story I did 3-4 months ago before the debate. And he said, if Biden loses Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and therefore the race, and unions didn't do enough to help Biden, all politicians in the future will say, why should we do any favors for unions? Because unions don't do anything, don't do enough for us. They're irrelevant. And I can imagine many union leaders saying, WTF with O'Brien. Biden moved heaven and earth to pass this Pension Relief Act that humongously helped the Teamsters. And O'Brien's, giving them, showing no solidarity, no thanks to the president who did so much to help the Teamsters. And I can imagine a lot of Democratic politicians moving forward will say, why should I do any favors for labor if they're just going to turn around and give a big wet kiss to Donald Trump?
So, no, that's a good point. Last question I've got for you. One of the themes of the speech clearly was this idea of we want to go back to some kind of bipartisanship. I think, President O'Brien went through and, said, we want to make what's best for the country. And we do that in a bipartisan way. And everybody, kumbaya, working in the same direction. And I got to tell you, it's nice words. Wish it were possible, but it seems like a mythical dream, because every time, and you can help me here if you agree or disagree, every time we see something truly done in a bipartisan way, overwhelmingly in a bipartisan way, it generally has workers taking it on the chin. And yesterday on the program, I talked about the Motor Carrier Act of 1980, something President O'Brien should know quite a lot about. It was overwhelming. It was veto-proof majorities. Overwhelmingly, everyone was on board, and the Teamsters Union got decimated because of that kind of bipartisanship. So I'm curious if you have a thought.
I'm going to dissent in part. Now I think you'll end up agreeing with me on this. So there was some important bipartisan action over the past 3.5-4 years, and that was Joe Biden, spearheading the effort to enact the Infrastructure Act, the $2 billion Infrastructure Act, which created.
How many Republicans?
Yeah, bipartisan. The Green Energy Act was bipartisan. The CHIPS Act was bipartisan. So like, O'Brien should have mentioned that if he's seriously about bipartisanship. That's my point. Like, you want bipartisan? Well, at least mention the guy who's really done it.
We're talking about a handful of Republicans.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really what I'm talking. I'm not talking. True bipartisanship is the majority of the House and the Senate. The vote on the Motor Carrier Act. There were 13 people in the House that voted against it, and 70 senators voted for it. That's the kind of bipartisanship I'm talking about. Yeah. Massive waves, not a handful of people, so we can call it bipartisanship. I'm talking about real, true, the kind of things that we're all working in the same direction. Right. Every time that happens, working people get screwed.
So, yes, it was kind of... It was nice when O'Brien talked about the importance of bipartisanship. It's nice when he said we want both parties working toward a pro-worker, pro-union agenda. But that's a pipe dream. That ain't going to happen, you know, unless, you know, everyone in the, many people in the GOP, you know, have a lobotomy, have shock treatment, and suddenly come out different people, pro-union, pro-worker. That's not going to happen.
I hope
it happens, but I don't see it, Rick. So,
Stephen, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. As always, you do amazing work. Everyone should be looking at your stuff. Stephen Greenhouse, thanks so much.
And we'll have a debate whether show pony or show horse is a better phrase. But thanks, Rick. Okay.
There you go. Same thought. I want to hear your thoughts. Good, bad? How's this going to play out down the road? Is this going to help Trump or not? I seem to think it's going to help. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. In the overnight, look for mostly clear skies, light winds, and by sunrise, temperatures will be in the mid and upper 50s. A very comfortable start to our Friday. By afternoon on Friday, we'll see mostly sunny skies, light southwest winds, highs near 80. Right now, it's 64.
100 days, 144,000 minutes. The countdown to the November presidential election is on, and Maggie Dawn is counting too as she continues her special segment, Biden's Top 100.
Having heard from each and every one of you, I should start talking about what President Biden is proposing us for his second term.
Biden's Top 100 continues. You're invited to be part of it too. Call or text the Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays starting at 2, across the Civic Media Radio Network and the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So the question is, how bad was Donald Trump for labor? His NLRB, his Department of Labor, the people who really have control over what happens in the workplace. How bad was their OSHA? How bad were those administrative agencies that are supposed to help working people? And what will the future look like? We've been talking about this Project 2025 and how bad it will be if our entire federal government is run by sycophants and loyalists. Understand, it's all about making patronage great again. And that patronage is loyalty to, well, the orange one himself. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how bad could it be? I've asked our good friend Carla Walter to come talk with us. She's a senior fellow for inclusive economy there at the Center for American Progress. They got a piece out right now. Project 2025 would undo the NLRB's progress on protecting workers' rights. And they say that this Project 2025, this policy playbook, they say offers instruction for future administrations to neuter the NLRB's enforcement capacity and turn it against unions by firing key agency leaders, making it easier to decertify unions, and closing off established ways to form unions. This is kind of the steal of Bidenism, kind of a big freaking deal. Carla, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So you have this report out that kind of says, hey, this is what this Project 2025 thing is going to do. Walk us through what you think, what could happen.
Well, I mean, I think it's important we look at the moment we're in right now. So we're in this moment where we've seen workers really in motion in new spaces to demand their rights on the job. And it's resulting in some significant wins across our economy in sectors where there has been historic power and in sectors where there has long been no power for workers. And so we're seeing wins for Starbucks workers across our economy. We're seeing UAW able to negotiate a historic contract, and really seeing how the government having the NLRB specifically on worker side and making sure that they get a fair say in both their elections and when it comes to negotiate a first contract and follow on contracts can really make a difference. So when we look at 2025 and we look at its plans, we can see that it's not only a plan to roll back all the progress of the Biden administration to not only have appointees that are on their side, but have rules and regulations that really create a fair playing field, but then take it even a step further than what President Trump did in his first administration.
Right. It's all about repealing the 20th century. We've been saying that for at least a decade now. That's the grand plan, to make us, desperate again. But here's the thing that's exciting to me, and you guys point out this out in your report, that, in 2023, the win rate for unions was 70%. That's a big freaking deal.
Yeah, it's the highest it's been in 15 years. We also see that when workers are retaliated against and fired, we see that in the first 3 years of the Biden administration, 50% more workers have been offered reinstatement for illegal firings as compared to all 4 years of the Trump administration. Workers are in motion and they're getting unions because they want it and they're willing to put it all on the line in order to get it. That said, having a government on their side makes a real difference, and we're seeing that now. And so when we have a Project 2025, not only saying, let's go back to what we had 4 years ago, but let's go back to what we had 100 years ago, it is quite scary, and it's quite scary for working people.
No, and look, as I say all the time, the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act, the NLRA, was to encourage workers to join and form unions. That is the mission. We haven't been moving in that way for a very long time, but I think the Biden administration is trying to uphold what that mission is by encouraging people to join and form unions, fight for better wages, hours, conditions in the workplace so that we don't have to have broad laws and the kind of inequality that we're living through right now.
Yeah, and it's not just unionization rights, it's baseline labor rights, whether we're talking about overtime or child labor, or Davis-Bacon Act wages that ensure that construction workers are paid market wages, all these things that have been on the books for really 100 years and have in the past had bipartisan support, they are talking about walking away from. And so this is really not just, I think sometimes there's this is what happens, this is what think tanks do. It's not just what think tanks do. This is a step further than what we've seen ever before. And it is a real reason to raise alarm bells.
Well, no, this is the machinery realizing they missed a real opportunity the first time Trump got elected because they didn't think he was going to win. This is the machinery going, next time we're not going to let a good opportunity to go to waste. And they've spent a lot of time, effort, and resources to put this together so that on day one, for the next 180 days, as I understand, they can make America, the 80s and 90s again and not the 1980s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. And they're not just talking about attacking private sector unions, which is concerning enough, but they also contemplates repealing public sector bargaining rights for federal workers. And as they do that, they talk about increasing the number of political appointees. That means that in every agency, what you'll be seeing is long-term public servants being pushed away from the job, and in their place, political appointees whose whole focus will be concentrating the power of the presidency and implementing all of these things that feel a little crazy as quickly as possible.
What do you say to the argument to that, though, that we need that to stand up against the Supreme Court? Because I don't know if you've been noticing, our Supreme Court seems kind of crazy.
I think we need a functioning government. That's what we need. We are a large country with lots of people from all, and lots of programs and services that do all sorts of things that we as everyday middle-class Americans need. We need functioning public schools. We need well-equipped social security systems that can support our seniors. We need all of these things to function together. We need roads and bridges that are built by workers who are well-qualified and will make sure they don't fall over. When we don't have the career staff, when we don't have decent wages, when we don't have folks on the job who know how to do the job, we're not going to have those things.
Now, we've seen the Supreme Court's recent ruling, the Chevron case that overturned the Chevron deference. That a lot of my labor friends are pointing to as something to be very concerned about, because they see it as an attack on potentially on the NLRB, potentially on OSHA, potentially on, you know, the wage and hour division, all of these agencies, these administrative agencies that help protect workers' rights. Do you see any of that? Are you concerned in the same way?
Yeah, I'm very concerned about rulemaking. We know that for a long time, you know, conservative courts have not given Labor Department tons of deference anyway. But that said, this is another, you know, nail in the coffin in terms of agencies' power to implement laws in ways that protect working people, that protect our environment, that protect kids. The other thing that I think is really concerning is we're also seeing Supreme Court cases coming where corporations are challenging the ability of administrative law judges to enforce the law, even when it's written into the law. So we have an NLRA that says that we have administrative law judges enforcing workers' fundamental rights, and even calling that into question. And it's the whole idea is by slowing down justice, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. That is the idea behind this. And we have to be really, really watchful of what's happening, what has happened and what will happen in terms of the Supreme Court.
No, I'm right there with you. But, you know, the concern is, and you, since you brought up, the court and the attacks on the NLRA, there's a push as we speak to undo parts of the National Labor Relations Act by people like Bezos and Musk and Trader Joe's to try and, you know, basically, you know, take us back to the Lochner era, to where if you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work in desperate conditions, deplorable conditions for poverty wages, hey, that was your freedom, Carla. That was your liberty.
And we see this with the courts, and we see this with 2025, where there's basically states get to choose. If states think that this labor standard will fundamentally live up to the goals of the underlying law, they can iterate on it and roll back our rights. So I think we're at a moment where policy matters a lot, and a lot is at stake.
There were a lot of decisions during the Trump years at the NLRB level that I think were important. I think of the Ferris decision that ended the joint employer rule. There are a lot of those things that I don't think we've talked about at all as a country. And I think there are those things that we should have an idea of, you know, what each side has done on the issue of workers' rights. I know Sean O'Brien spoke at the RNC and didn't bring up any of the record of the Trump administration, or the Biden administration for that matter either. He leant back to, well, they both suck. And I don't think that to be the reality. I think the Trump years were really bad. And there were a bunch of decisions that were really bad.
The Trump administration rolled back protections for working people, whether it be through their labor rights or their workplace protections. I mean, he even tried to make tip stealing legal. Like, there's just, it was basically there was anything was up for grabs when it came to worker protections. And it was my biggest concern is that it was slowed by incompetence. And as you said, there is going to be, if we end up with the Project 2025 guiding policymaking in the future, there will be an additional level of competence where I think that we will see a lot of these reforms move faster and be harder to undo.
And it's scary stuff, because during those years, some really bad stuff popped up. I think about the forced arbitration clauses. My aunt, who had worked for a company for, you know, 20 some years, called me, you know, frantic one day and said her employer said, sign this or there's the door. And she didn't know what it was. And it was a forced arbitration clause that if something were to happen, age discrimination, because she was older, you know, gender discrimination, whatever, you wouldn't get to go to court. You'd have to go to an arbitrator. And she's like, well, do I sign it? I go, well, you can sign it, or they're going to walk you out the door because you don't have a union. You're in an at-will employment state. So that's your choice. Sign it or don't. And that's the kind of, those are the kind of things I think people need to know about as we march into November.
Oh, yeah. And well, the Project 2025, it contemplates numerous protections for corporations in terms of their religious freedoms. It actually rolls back key enforcement agencies when it comes to anti-discrimination protections for workers. So I think that workers are have should be scared about what this project could mean for and what these proposals could mean for them in the future.
No, absolutely. And the thing is this is the part that gets me. They wrote it down. So we can go read. No, I mean, this is how brazen they are. They've written it down. They're going, this is what we're going to do to you. And we know you're not going to read it. And that's basically, I think, or is there another message there? I think that's what they're saying. We're telling you how bad we're going to be for you working people, but we don't think you're going to read it.
They not only wrote it down, but they bulleted it. I keep talking to people who say, well, I haven't read it yet. I'm like, read it. It's so fast. It's so easy to read. And it's so clear how bad it is. They don't hide anything.
But it's 900 pages.
It's 900 pages, but you can skim.
No, and look, you know, we talked about the trade adjustment assistance part of it the other day. You know, just the fact that they're like, there shouldn't be any such thing. But if there is, we should just treat you like anybody else who loses their job. Tough luck, buddy. And they've written that down.
I'm shocked about the, you know, I'm shocked about the Davis-Bacon piece. It's the law that's been on the books since 1933. We still have Republicans in Congress who support it. It has been shown to support not only better standards for workers, but you get more bidders for jobs because they know they're not going to get undercut. These are things that are not just progressive in terms of raising standards for people, but they're very practical.
Yeah.
The thing about child labor and allowing kids to be at hazardous work sites, they say that clearly, that they want to have more opportunity for children to explore hazardous work sites as career opportunities. I mean, it does feel like someone might have been writing this with a quill. It just is that you know.
No, look, because here's the thing: you're walking right into my wheelhouse here, because they are loosening child labor laws around the country. They are trying to destroy public education. They're trying to privatize our education. Well, if your kids can't afford an education, there's always this dangerous job over here.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they tell us. I think the guy who wrote it, the Kevin Roberts, said this is the second American Revolution. You know, we're coming for you. Will we listen? I guess that's the question, isn't it?
That is the question. And they are not empty threats. We're seeing states do this over and over again across the country, and many of these reforms or regressions. And we really need to take this seriously.
So I know you've spent a lot of time with it. What's the worst thing in there? Now, look, you talked about prevailing wage, and me as someone who believes wholeheartedly in prevailing wage or Davis-Bacon, because I know that it has an incredible reverberation effect across the economy. It creates, you know, not just the jobs of building infrastructure that pay good wages, but that money that gets spent in the local economy helps small businesses, helps education. It's a great way to get the local economy moving. Outside of attacking that, other than all of it, what's the worst part of it?
I mean, I don't pick a favorite kid, and I'm not going to pick a least favorite policy from this project. One of the things that I feel like folks haven't been focusing on enough, two things that I think folks haven't been focusing on enough. One is taking away real overtime protections and allowing your boss to sub it out with standard, like, you know, vacation time, like sort of off the books vacation time. That to me just feels like you're just stealing pay right out of people's paychecks. The other piece that I think that isn't getting talked enough about in terms of unions is preventing them from advocating for policy in our government. What we know about unions is the way they make the middle class strong is they do two things. One, they advocate for workers in their workplace. But the other thing is they're the folks behind getting Obamacare passed. They're the folks behind getting minimum wages, higher minimum wage standards passed in all sorts of cities across America, including many cities in red states. So I think that taking away that ability for it as one of the few organizations that's able to advocate for the economic interests of the middle class, and pulling that away, we'd see real consequences really quickly.
How would that happen? I mean, look, you know, one of the things I say all the time, I've been a Teamster for 35 years. I've always said I've got a voice in Congress because the Teamsters do go and lobby for work interests. They go lobby for things that I think are important to help me get me to be able to earn better wages, hours, conditions, all of that. How would they stifle that?
they would say that by advocating for those policies, you would not be fairly representing all members because some of your members might not agree with those policies, ignoring the fact that those members can just pay agency fees and then not have to worry about those issues. So it's like basically cutting, having right to work and then having an additional right to work on top of it.
I'm hearing you tell me this stuff. I'm hearing you tell you this stuff, and my mind cannot get away from you know President Sean O'Brien's speech. This kumbaya, we're gonna all work together. We're gonna all do great things. Boy, Josh Hawley's a good dude. J.D. Vance is a good dude. Cares about workers. And now you're telling me the grand plan under all of this is to destroy all of it. I get it.
Yeah, I mean it's clear. The writing is literally, you know, can be at anyone's fingertips, anyone that with time they want to see it. And it's, the plan is clear. The people who are going to be instituting it are clear. We know what they want to do. And, you know, it's there's a lot at stake.
Yeah. As I say, they're honest. If we're dumb enough to vote for them, maybe we deserve what we get, I guess. Maybe I've been saying for a very long time, the only time we really come together as a country is when there's crisis and disaster. So maybe we need a good kick in the pants. I don't know. But Carla, I appreciate the thoughts. Good stuff as always. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Carla Walter, Senior Fellow for Inclusive the Economy there at the Center for American Progress. Check out their website, americanprogress.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
This day in labor history, the year was 1919. That Friday, thousands of workers in the Chicago stockyards walked off the job. A serious union organizing drive had been underway in the yards since June. One of the organizers of the butchers was John Kikulski. John declared it would be a campaign that included workers who were Polish, Irish, Lithuanian, and in fact, every race, color, creed, and nationality. This was an important pledge because earlier unionization efforts had failed to unite the workforce and had often excluded black workers. Yet the years of racial barriers to unionize proved hard to break down. While 90% of the white workers joined the union, black recruitment lagged behind. Tensions between the newly arriving Eastern European workers and more established white workers also simmered. Despite these setbacks, the stockyard owners were alarmed by the success of the union drive. They sent in 300 mounted policemen to disrupt union meetings and monitor the workers' movements. Angered at the police presence, 10,000 workers walked off the job. They returned to work on Monday, but began organizing for a strike. On July 26th, the workers issued their demands to management for better pay and safer working conditions. The next day would be one of the most infamous days in Chicago history. A group of white Chicagoans stoned and killed a black boy who was swimming and had accidentally drifted into a whites-only part of Lake Michigan. For the next week, a race riot engulfed the neighborhoods surrounding the stockyards. 1,000 black families lost their homes to arson. 23 black and 15 white residents were killed. Any hope of racial unity had been crushed, and as a result, the strike failed. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So during the break, I went and I looked up the prevailing wage part of the Project 2025 that Carla was talking about. And it's interesting that you go through and they do nothing but talk about how they want to end project labor agreements, how they want to go after, they want to end Davis-Bacon. But the line that got my attention that said, you know, repealing the Davis-Bacon Act would increase worker freedom and end the long-standing effective tax on American families. What they're saying here is your freedom. And again, this is what I keep saying, understand where they want to take us. They want to move us back to the Lochner era.
where government can make no rules of overtime. They can make no rules on minimum wage. They can make no rules on safe working conditions, on child labor. You name it, no rules. So you go, you know, we have a lot of rules now. We'd like to get rid of some of them. No, no. They want to take us back to a time where corporate America dominates everything. And this mythical idea that there's this invisible hand and the free market is at work and the free market sets the natural wage, which is ludicrous on so many levels. So much so that the economic profession came up with the word monopsony, which means corporate power having the ability to suppress wages. Yeah, that happens. But this idea of repealing the Davis-Bacon Act or prevailing wage laws, giving workers freedom, you know, because who's against freedom? Who could possibly be against freedom? So what do you think it really is about? According to the report, they believe that prevailing wage increases the cost of construction labor by 10%. That's the number that they're using. I've heard them say 30%. So evidently, you know, non-union construction workers are doing a lot better. I don't think so, but yep, that's what they're saying. And it's not like we know because they're not reporting it. But let's say it is 10%. They want workers to work for 10% less. That's what they're saying. We want you to work for less money. Now, understand, I think it's more around where the numbers that I've heard, somewhere between 18 and 30% in the construction industry, where unionized workers make better wages, better benefits, have better conditions, safer workplaces, all that stuff. Now, what they say is, well, it costs too much to do the projects. And I say, well, the reality is those people, those union construction workers, the best trained, because they have an incredible apprenticeship program. They have continual education programs to ensure that their skills are continually expanded and practiced and all of that. So you end up getting better work. And I always look at the glaring example of the battle of two bridges on each coast. In California, Governor Schwarzenegger tried to build a non-union Chinese bridge out there, the Bay Bridge, with again, you know, non-union labor, or Chinese labor in some cases, and Chinese steel. The bridge is never going to get done, from what I'm told. It just can't be finished because the products are, the materials are constantly breaking down. They've got so many problems with it. It's probably never going to officially be done, from what I'm told. Way over budget. Again, no project labor agreement, no prevailing wage. Way over budget, way over time. Actually never going to be done. Then you look at the bridge in New York, the replacement of the Tappan Zee, which was done with a project labor agreement and done on time and under budget, oddly enough, with all union labor. And again, this is reality. This isn't some, you know, think tank, ivory tower think tank telling us what they hope and they want. This is real world examples. Now, the wages that those workers earned in New York, those union workers who do, in, you know, dangerous work, you wouldn't have caught me out in the middle of the Hudson River trying to put that bridge together. Those wages go back into the community. So if you have workers who have, what's that thing that most workers don't have anything anymore? Oh, yeah, disposable income. If you have some disposable income, you're going to spend it in the local economy. You're going to go to the local movie theater, the local restaurants. You're going to help small business. You know, order pizza maybe more often. You're going to do other things with that money. Maybe save some, but we're Americans. We don't save much. We spend. So that helps grow the economy. Weird how that works. When people have money, they spend it. When people have money to spend, businesses go, hey, how do we get that money? How do we get them to spend it on our stuff? And it creates a really nice kind of economy. The other side of this, what Project 2025 folks are saying, no, we're going to starve the workers so that they basically don't have disposable income. And, well, those small businesses in town, they're going to give way to the big behemoths. So no more Main Street. We're just going to have... you know, not even big box retailers anymore. We're going to be buying our stuff from China. But it's amazing to me that this, they're writing this stuff down. They're telling us what they're going to do. And the sad reality is I don't think that, you know, I listened to the guy Betsy or whatever his name was on Monday night at the RNC convention, the steam fitter, who's like, we're all in for Donald Trump. Has he read this? Because this is coming after him and his members. They end prevailing wage. We'll see. Want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. And as always, check out the video, freespeech.org. And thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls. W228EP Eau Claire. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.